Marys.webs.com.
That's right, and you'll find the river.
Okay.
The song on that home page.
All right. Well, thank you.
You'll actually find.
I'll look that up during the week, and you please stay in touch. I appreciate your spirit.
I'll be calling you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
And thank you for remembering. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air. Hello.
Hey, hello. Good evening. How are you?
Good.
How you making, brother? How you making?
All right. Can you help us from the military amnesia takeover? The military amnesia deconstitutional process?
Yeah. Let me be very clear. We play too much, right? We posture. We want political change without a program. They want a civil rights investigation of the death of Trayvon Martin, right? That's the wrong, and we get so seduced easily by that. We know we don't need to investigate. He's murdered, so his civil rights are already done. The question is local government corruption. That's the question. Two, Obama has disarmed us from our common sense. We're just rocket boosters of the payload because mm-hmm. we're mobilized for our loyalty mm-hmm. to a corporate harlot.
There's a word for that. There's a word for that. People are fond of him. And by fond, I mean the archaic meaning of the word, meaning stupid.
Yeah, because politically...
And that's with a U, not O-O in the vernacular. Like stupid, but dumb.
But because here, we have been so seduced where we're not a constituency where he has to answer to. Because, like, the question is this. We had buckwheat for 3 years. What do we have to show for it? We have lost more property.
And more rights.
Right. But yet, the argument is that the GOP is the worst. Okay, fine. I'm your political brother. What does the lesser evil actually mean? I bomb your house. Let's say for 2 weeks outside of not bombing your house for 2 months.
And then they say the other side, well, you see, the other side is going to bomb your house. But we believe in deflagration, not detonation. And we're only going to burn your house.
Yeah. Because, see, the crisis is black political leadership. Because mm-hmm. black political leadership, no offense to people who have religion, has been a whole bunch of preacher pundits. Hmm. Meaning this, faith or to be religious is to believe in things you don't have evidence of, thus we don't approach this thing scientifically.
Listen, I'm going to have to leave it at this or just a few more syllables. What you say. Why did you call me earlier, brother?
I just walked in, man, to get off the plantation.
Well, listen, call me next week. I want to continue and refine this discussion.
I'll give you a holler next week if I can.
Okay, thank you.
Peace.
And finally, you're on the air. Hello.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Not to sound like we're playing a parlor game, but here's an interesting question for the listeners, and it should be said this. Name the one thing that everybody claims that they want, but nobody likes when they get it. And the answer would be the truth.
and that's
an interesting question because as we're seeing throughout the entire world, and it has to be understood. We are seeing Libyans or Arabs for the people that they really are. And as for this mm-hmm. Barack fellow, we pretty much saw what he really is, too. So, I mean, I don't ever recall him ever saying that he was for change in that context. He said it, but I never recall that anything he said would have... Applicated.
Well, you know, accelerating on the road to tyranny is technically a change.
Yes, in theory, but But the question was never about defending the crisis. And I said to myself, I listened to you very, very attentively discuss this, and I said, here we are, the masses, the so-called people, the revolution, the context. This is why I never trust the masses in anything.
Democracy, mob rule,
and
uninformed mob rule at that.
Democracy, because everybody forgets this.
Okay, gotta go. You're good. Why y'all? See, it's It's just like sex. The climax comes at the end. But y'all need to call earlier in the show so that we can have a fuller discussion, please. Well, and that just about completes this discussion. This is Earthwatch, and we've been commemorating the life and the pointers in the wisdom that we're trying to help kin and extend from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this anniversary of his untimely having been taken from us. So that concludes this edition of Earthwatch. We'll be back next Wednesday at midnight. And do stay tuned for another fine show. Jim Freund is arriving with a new edition of Hour of the Wolf. So stay tuned for that. Please send me emails. Let's prepare for this discussion next week about the military class and constitutional destructions and the placing of inappropriate people and procedures in positions of perceived authority. There is a new military return to America, and it scares the death out of me. So thank you. R-Night, R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org, R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org. And welcome, Jim Freund. You have the con, sir.
Thank you. Well, it's because it's a recorded interview, it's extremely tight, so we better just get started. Ta-da-da-da. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. To get along with all of these, well, we have a wonderful writer, Nebula Award nominated for this year, in fact, Tom Crosshill, in an interview and reading recorded a month ago. Stay tuned. And again, good morning. For those of you who came to the last New York Review of Science Fiction readings, which was in fact just last night, Alaya Dawn Johnson and E.C. Myers, and a special guest, Sam Weber, cover artist. Can see his work at sampaints.com. I gotta say, boy, was that a lot of fun, and wanted to thank everybody who read and everybody who showed up. We had a pretty nice crowd and all that. And as I mentioned earlier, over the theme music, or over Robert, tonight's show is fairly tight because I recorded this interview. Tom lived in Brooklyn, and now he is back in Latvia, which is actually where he originally comes from. And he was in town for a little while, and I had a chance to record him as he was passing through. Not long, just days after he had found out that his short story that you are going to hear this morning was nominated for the Nebula Award. And we talk about that a lot. Now, we recorded an hour and 40 minutes, which is fine for a 90-minute show. But unless you have some kind of a time TARDIS, that means we're rather tight on time. I have edited the first half. And as we are playing the first half, I'm going to be editing the second half. So this is really one of those as they come. Robert is very used to this kind of a thing. He's a news guy, so he knows exactly what I was talking about. So without any further ado, let me see if Tom has a little bio that's right in front of me. But you can look him up, by the way. His website is TOMCROSSHILL, TomCrossHill.com. And the Wi-Fi here is so lousy. I'm better off turning it off. But you will learn a lot about Tom simply by listening to the interview. So let's go straight to that. And we'll talk again at halftime. Till, who was a New Yorker.
For a while.
For what, about 3 years?
Well, it depends on how you define it. I lived in Stamford, Connecticut, exciting, for a couple of years. And
that's
then I moved
a suburb
to the city
of New
proper.
York.
So, yeah. Yes, 4 years total, I guess.
Okay. And you are a citizen of where?
I am a Latvian writer. I grew up in Latvia. I went to school in Latvia. Then I came to the U.S. for about 8 years, and I returned about a year ago. I went back home.
Okay. And any particular reason that you care to share, or just say, let's move on?
No. Actually, you know, I 8 months ago, I just decided I wanted to write full time. I was ready to be done with my day job, so I quit my job and moved back home, and now I'm living cheaply and writing, and you know, life is good.
And you've had really boring day jobs. I think operating a nuclear reactor.
Yeah, that was during college. I did I did operate our research reactor for a bit. I've done all sorts of things, like worked inside this Japanese zinc mine one summer, and you know, did some undergraduate research on general relativity and translated some books, and I just try to do various things like theater and music and science and everything that crosses my path, just to keep life interesting.
Ooh, and you see, you caught my ear with the theater and the music and stuff, because, of course, I'm always going, ooh, theater, ooh.
Yeah, well, I guess the most fun I had with theater was the senior year of college, when I directed this 25-people production of Terry Pratchett's The Truth. That was like a 3-hour production. It was this big, big thing that pretty much, when I should have been writing my thesis, I spent 24 hours a day just worrying about it, like stressing out and losing hair. But it was so much
yes.
fun in the
end. Theater is amazing. Yes. I've done a few showcases.
Yeah.
So I'm familiar with the wonderful insanity that it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's so satisfying while it's going on. Of course, afterward, it's gone, and, you know, it can feel a little empty sometimes. A lot of theater people complain about that.
But I certainly do. I worked on a show that off Broadway was moved, went to Broadway, won the Tony Award for Best Play. And I tell this to people, and I tell people how I worked with Matthew Broderick and Harvey Fierstein and all these, you know, huge stars today. And to me, it doesn't sound real. It's all this ethereal. Yeah. I mean, at least I have air checks of radio shows.
Yeah.
I have nothing, nothing at all to show that I've worked on three shows in the theater, one of which got a Tony Award.
I mean, it disappears. I mean, you have some pictures. You might even have a video, but it's nothing like the real thing. Well, too bad.
Too bad. But also, whenever I am with a writer who says, oh, yes, I've worked in, you know, with theater arts and things like that, my first thought is, have you ever considered radio drama?
Well, actually, no, I haven't, but maybe I will now.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's part of my job is planting seeds.
Yes. So down the line, we'll see. No, all I've done in theater was, some stuff in college. And then when I got to New York for a while, I explored the local improv comedy scene. And I learned a lot from that. I never got very far as personal performance goes, but I learned a real lot from that, both for writing and just, for living life. It's learning improv is such a great thing for personal development. I could recommend it to anyone.
Mm-hmm. How does that, or does that at all, relate to the written word?
Oh, I think it relates a lot. I mean, one of the things you learn when doing improv is that whatever character you create, you really have to establish that character quickly, and you have to know what that character's philosophy, what is that, or her outlook on life is. And that really forces you to think about what constitutes a character and how you present it. And when you're writing, a lot of the time you see authors trying to write something and meandering for pages and pages, and the character isn't well defined. You're not sure who that person is. And it really helps, if you teach yourself to focus and, establish those things quickly and not be afraid of, you can't be afraid of a blank page. You know, a lot of people get writer's block and they complain, I'm stuck. I have this blank page staring at me. I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. But once you've been on the stage with this, quote unquote, blank page staring at you, I mean, that's a whole different level of stress, and it kind of teaches you to get past that. And
yeah. When people have nightmares, it's usually about standing in front of an audience,
right,
either naked or without a word to say, or better yet, both.
Right, exactly.
They don't tend to have their nightmares about them sitting in front of a blank computer screen going, what am I supposed to be writing now? I know, I'll go on Facebook.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Which.
So it's good training, and not just improv. I've found classical theater to be extremely helpful. In particular, there is a book by Michael Shurtleff called Audition, which is very widely used in theater education about, it prepares actors for auditions.
I have to read this.
But it's actually an excellent book for any writer because he has these 12 guideposts to acting, to creating scenes, which are the same basically for any writer writing a scene. He talks about, characterization. He talks about the conflict in a scene. He talks about the contradictions in a scene, the history of a scene, all these things, which, I learned a huge amount from that. But yeah, there's certainly a lot that I've learned from theater, and I think a lot of that comes through in my stories. If you look at how they're structured, and especially how the character relationships work, a lot of that comes directly out of scene work.
Mm-hmm.
The way I think about a scene is, if you look at a play, if you look at a script, the director's job in theater is to bring out the meaning between the lines, and the author's job, sometimes to make explicit or at least imply more strongly the meaning between the lines. You have to be a little more explicit than a playwright, so you have to do the work of the director for the audience sometimes. You can't do it too much, otherwise the audience, you can't tell the audience everything, but the writer has to do some of the performing, not just the the lines of dialogue that a playwright does.
Yeah. So how does this lead toward speculative fiction?
Well,
because this is wonderful and I'm having a great time chatting and
sure,
war stories and all that. But at a certain point, at this point, you would describe yourself primarily as a science fiction writer, or at least a spec fic writer.
And I've always been that, since I was 11 or 12. But for me, I mean, it's...
Because, you know, you go to a bar and you ask somebody who's serving you drinks what they do for a living, and the answer is they're an actor or a director.
Right.
You don't go to too many actors and performers and say, what do you do? And they say, I'm a science fiction writer.
Right. Well, I mean, the way I look at it, for me, mostly science fiction and fantasy, those are ways of talking about real life. I mean, you know, for me, science fiction largely acts as a metaphor for real life problems, real life issues, and, you know, a way of injecting wonder into real life also. So most of my stories are very much driven by real relationships and, you know, the problems that people actually face in life, even if it's clad in very exotic's not the right word, but colorful imagery. So, you know, you have to know how people relate. You have to understand how relationships work if you want to write good science fiction. Otherwise, it's just going to be some technical manual with some, you know, two robot voices talking to each other with no real, you know, it's hard to connect with that. You have
to. Which is what science fiction was largely in the 20s.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah.
And, you know, the Hugo Gernsback style. Ralph 124C41 plus is,
right. And you know, in the beginning, that's interesting when it's a novelty. You know, like, I've never seen that before. That's cool. Let's do some of that. But after a while, you might just read, you know, Scientific American or something if you just want something that little kick of wonder.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, Gernsback. These were electronics magazines.
Yeah.
That he was publishing in the 20s.
Right.
And then he started injecting scientific shin.
Yeah.
In them, and then he decided to launch a magazine, Amazing Stories, right. That was just that stuff. And even then, he was still putting science stories into the science fiction magazine.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what it was. And to this day, it's noteworthy that some decent fiction is coming out of, say, Wired magazine.
Yeah.
You know, which now that Geek is no longer a... an epithet,
right. You know, we're definitely moving more and more toward human relationships in science fiction stories. I mean, if you look at Analog magazine, which has been the flagship of hard science fiction and focused on science fictional ideas and all that, the best regarded, best reviewed, and you know, most celebrated stories in Analog from the past few years have all been actually very emotion-driven, very human character-driven. Even though they have these cool science fictional ideas at the core, I don't see anybody these days, hardly anybody, doing pure science fictional exploration, with a few exceptions of a few stories here and there. But mostly, you know, that human element has to be there or we don't accept it anymore.
Yeah. But I think that's something that changed only in maybe the late 40s. And only with people like Theodore Sturgeon, who started really injecting people, or at least characters, not just, oh, that's really a character, a la Heinlein, where he would have, you know, colorful creations.
Right.
But, you know, people who had subtext, who had, you know, a purpose.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that a lot of readers who are non-readers who, when they think of science fiction, that's the thing that keeps them away, is they don't realize it's literature.
Right. And, you know, honestly, the problem is that, you know, almost all of us try it, but there is plenty of science fiction out there that does it very badly, because, you know, that's the part that people haven't focused on that much, like the human relationship aspect. And, you know, that's the reason I think a lot of science fiction writers could benefit from some theater training or, you know, that or, you know, just, of course, literary fiction and all that. Because, I mean, there is a lot of value and a lot we can borrow from literary, you know, so-called literary fiction, the mainstream realist fiction that's out there. You know, a lot of the time it seems like we're banging heads and we're really fighting, you know, genre frowns on mainstream frowns on genre, but in fact there's a lot we can borrow from each other, and we are doing that. I mean, if you read Wired just had this interview with I never know how to pronounce his name, Michael Chabon, but he had this great interview, actually I think it was off of John Joseph Adams's
Geek's Guide to the Galaxy
podcast, and he talked about this, how, you know, he rejected this division between literary realist fiction and then genre fiction is something that's not worthy.
Yeah, and one may point out to the listeners who don't know, Chabon is a Pulitzer Prize winning writer.
Yeah.
He is somebody who made his name in literary fiction. And then when so many people were saying, oh, I don't write science fiction, I write literature.
Yeah.
He says nonsense to that. You write what you write. And by the way, pulp stuff is great, which is why he wrote the screenplay for John Carter.
Right. And, you have.
Which is why I have hope for John Carter.
You have people doing it from the other direction as well, such as Jonathan Latham, who started out more on the science fictional end. But he writes brilliant literary fiction. And even things in between, like if you read The Fortress of Solitude, it has a speculative element. But it's such a fantastic book and it evokes such a sense of reality, like few other books that I've read.
Latham is a great example because Latham at one time denied that he wrote speculative fiction or science fiction. Mm-hmm. He had what I call Vonnegut's disease, which is the realization that if you call your stuff science fiction, the publisher is less likely to buy it, or else they'll just pigeonhole it right. and not put it up front with right. the other books.
And it's been a real concern, but I think we're slowly, fortunately, moving away from that. I mean, for instance,
by the way, to his credit, Latham denounced his former yeah. attitude and is totally with it today. But sorry, go on.
No, I just wanted to mention as an example. I'm Latvian, and my first book just came out in Latvian. It was translated to Latvian, a collection of my short stories. And what really surprised me and really pleased me was that not only did it get a huge amount of critical attention, it was all attention from mainstream critics who would normally look at, whatever literary novels were coming out. And there was very little prejudice. I mean, people did say things like, normally when we look at science fiction, we think it's crap. But, in this case, we see that it's... So there was a little bit of that sort of kind of language around it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what I wrote was pretty much straight up science fiction, sometimes even hard science fiction. But they, they did accept it. I think the saturation of media, we have so much science fiction everywhere around us these days, and people are starting to accept it and understand that it can be done well and it can be literary.
Yeah, and yet it's been 40 years or so since writers like Le Guin and all that hit the scene where it became obvious that there's literature here.
Yeah.
And yet to this day, you will get people say, well, it's science fiction, but it's really actually quite good.
Right, right, exactly.
And that's like, why is that word but instead of and?
I think there are many reasons, but it's so ingrained in the academic scene, and I've heard people say that their English professor would never accept science fiction
any
of that. I mean, that's very.
I was failed in high school.
Yeah.
Grade school, for doing a book review of The Martian Chronicles, and I was furious.
Yeah.
Asked the teacher, what if I had done 1984 and I got the standard, that's not science fiction, that's literature.
Right. And that's all in your head, but you
can't prove it. And this is 1963, and I'm talking about a book called 1984, which is, of course, really about 1948, but that's a whole other
–
but it's science fiction. That's all that it is.
Yeah.
It's that and more.
Yeah.
So it's still – it's interesting that there is still this stigma attached – and when Hour of the Wolf began in 1972, science fiction was that Star Trek stuff. Then for a while, it became that Star Wars stuff. Mm-hmm. And today, it's Marvel Comics, if
right.
I tell people. It's like, the Avengers are opening up. Yeah. And I'm going, I love Steven Peel.
But, I had a funny experience a couple of days ago. I was talking to somebody, and this person said, I used to hate science fiction. I used to really look down on it. But then my boyfriend got me into Battlestar Galactica, and I was like, this is so great.
Well, hopefully it was the second Battlestar Galactica,
yes, the
not
new
the
one,
first.
The new
yes.
one. So,
by the way, they're trying it again. The next big TV series, Space 2099.
Hmm.
They're taking space 1999, which is one of the worst. If there was a show worse than Battlestar Galactica, it was Space 1999 with Martin Landau and Barbara Bain, and they're rebooting that. But hopefully they're going to reboot it like they rebooted Battlestar.
One can always hope.
Yes. One can hope.
Yes. But, you know, occasionally we are seeing some high-quality media speculative fiction. I mean, Game of Thrones, obviously. We have Battlestar Galactica. We have... No, actually, you know, when I think about the future and what I'd like to do, and if I ever do anything in media, I think that these days TV is really becoming a very, very powerful medium for telling long-form storytelling, not just episodic, but like long story arcs. I mean, HBO is doing a lot of that. There were some great shows like
they're going to be doing Neil Gaiman next year.
And then Game of Thrones and other ones. And there's just such a fantastic medium when it's done well, when you have high production values and good writers and good actors working on it. It can be much more powerful than a movie, at least, you know, for me as a viewer.
Yeah, I think movies could do it, but movies have one problem, which is that the studios that put them out think that people should stop at 2 hours or 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with the concept of, oh, let's say a 7-hour movie. I really don't.
With a bathroom break in between.
With a dinner break.
Yeah.
Absolutely, with a dinner break. Uh-huh. Or watch part one tonight and part two tomorrow night. Yeah.
Well, there are some...
The Russians do it all the time. And people are the Russian version of War and Peace. There was this woman who did this 7 or 8 hour version of Little Dorrit by Dickens. Mm. And these movies fared very well.
Yeah. Well, there are some logistical challenges, but you can do it that way. I mean, obviously, we have like Harry Potter being adapted and other things that have multiple parts and do quite well.
And that's actually a good example, because when you get down to it, that is a series. That is a segmented thing.
A really high-quality TV show, yeah.
Well, it was. I mean, or I just call it a series of movies, which is what it was. It started as a book, but by the time she wrote the third book, the first movie was out or coming out. And it got to a point where the movies were starting to inform the books, that at a certain point – when J.K. Rowling was writing a character, she knew that Snape looked like Alan Rickman, that this person looked like that.
You can't avoid that when you have people as powerful as Alan Rickman. You know, it just sticks in your mind.
Well, the cast, I mean, half of what made those movies great was brilliant casting.
Yeah.
And Rickman, that.
Yeah.
I love Alan Rickman. But anyway.
Yeah.
So you could see yourself going into media.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking in general terms. In general, I try not to think of writing in too narrow a way. I think, you know, nobody knows what the 21st century is going to look like for publishing and for writers. But I'm sure there will be room for storytelling, and there will be ways for storytellers to survive. And you may need to, be flexible and work in different media and, you know, write novels, maybe write games, write movies. It may take different shapes and forms.
Naomi Novik wrote fanfic and games. That's how she started, you know, before the Temeraire books.
Right. And it's all, I mean, you can do good storytelling in all those media. And I love all sorts of media. I love books. I in the past, have played a lot of games. These days, I don't, for some reason, I can't get into it anymore. But I would love to write a game someday or, you know, movies and TV, of course.
What were you reading? You said Heinlein and McCaffrey. What were the things that helped formulate the writer you are today?
You know, it was a lot of different inspirations, but most of it was somewhat speculative in nature. I mean, when I was growing up, a lot of it was the Scandinavian writers like Astrid Lindgren. You guys know, you know, Pippi Longstocking, but she had brilliant books like The Brothers Lionheart. They were just brilliant. And there was Tove Jansson, who wrote the Moomin books, which, you know, some people are aware of here. So that kind of kick-started it. And then when I got older,
What language were you reading these in?
Oh, these were translated to Latvian.
Okay.
And of course, there was
the... How many languages do you have?
Well, it depends. I can probably get through a book in Latvian, English, Russian, German, and maybe Spanish. But, you know, it's, you know... There's a big difference between getting through a book and being fluent. So, But yeah,
I do Brooklyn, by the way. That's about it. But,
I read these in Latvian, and of course I also read the. I don't know if many Americans are aware of this, but in Soviet Russia, this guy Volkov put out a book called "The Wizard of the Emerald City," and basically it was a pirated version of Oz. And you know, some sequels as well. And to this day, I prefer, you know, that and all the sequels to the actual Oz, because just that's what I grew up with. And so that informed my outlook a lot as well. And then I got into Heinlein, I got into McCaffrey, I got into all the big names, and Robin Hobb, and all the big American writers. We had a good library where I grew up, fortunately, with books in English, so that's what got me started.
Because I was going to ask how the translations were.
Yeah, no, there wasn't that much translated, and you know, if I didn't have all those books in English, I wouldn't be able to write in English today. And so I'm kind of grateful for how that worked out.
What now we're getting into like inner space territory. Do you think in any one language?
This
is Noam Chomsky type question.
It's kind of like pattern switching. I can switch here, I think, in English. Back home, I think, in Latvian. I was just in Cuba for 5 weeks. And in Cuba, it was really hard, because at times I would think in English and Latvian, a little bit of Spanish, a little bit of Russian because of the people I was traveling with. And then, you know, there were also people talking Armenian around me. So we were like switching between 5 different languages.
Oh,
and I would constantly burst out in the wrong language. Whomever I was talking to, I would just start talking in the wrong language. It can get a little complicated that way.
Yeah, but it sounds wonderful to me. I mean, this is hopefully one of the things the 21st century, as it progresses, if things go well, will achieve our more universal speaking. And if not the universal translator, Google Translate is, I would say, at this point, 30% accurate.
Right.
And I think that in 5 years, it's going to be 60% accurate. And in 10 years, we're going to have a translator.
Well, I think, yeah, they'll be able to translate.
I have it with me, by the way, if you want to try it out.
No, I've tried it out, and it's still very problematic. But you can kind of understand the core meaning of things.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Where's the bathroom? You know, that's the phrase.
Right,
that's the phrase I need to know everywhere.
It's... Yeah. Yeah. No. Definitely. I mean, it's also very good just to be able to read in other languages and kind of there's German fantasy that I've enjoyed. I'm now trying to read some things in Spanish and just, you know, get that sense of how another literary tradition approaches writing. And also let that inform my writing, perhaps, and you know, find something that might appeal to English reading people, and something fresh and different.
Yeah, I think people are beginning to discover German fantasy and don't even know that that's what it is.
Mm.
There is this trope of fairy tales coming out. We're not just, you know, we're going beyond the Ellen Datlow, Terry Wendling rewriting of fairy tales, where right now we have a series on TV called Grimm,
mm-hmm.
another one called Once Upon a Time,
mm-hmm.
a movie coming out, Mirror, Mirror.
Yeah.
I mean, there's 3 Snow White projects at once.
And then you have the Fable, the famous comic book series, and or Fables, I'm not sure. It's by Bill Willingham. It's also just retelling of fairy tales in modern.
Yeah, but I was thinking actually of German. I was thinking of Grimm and, you know, the household tales,
mm-hmm.
as they would properly be called. I think that right now there's a huge resurgence of those old Grimm tales when people don't even necessarily know.
That's what it is. Right.
Yeah, the derivation of these things. Sometimes the producers don't necessarily know.
Yeah. That's definitely true.
So it's wonderful to be able to read that stuff. And then what happens, and this is why I asked about the translations, there was a new translation of the Grimm stories maybe 15 years ago, and all of a sudden people said, I didn't realize that it was like this or like that.
Right.
And they weren't Disneyized or
right. Yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, it can be, there's a... You know, you have to be careful not to just, like, strip mine these things and... it's easy to kind of commercialize it and forget about the what was there originally. But I think you can also find ways to treat it with respect and bring out interesting new ideas. I've tried some of that. I have a story coming out later this year in Beneath Ceaseless Skies, which is a great online magazine for kind of epic fantasy and that sort of thing. And it's called Bear Slayer and the Black Knight. And it's based on this Latvian national epic, the Bear Slayer, which is about this hero that fought the Black Knight, which represented German invaders. So it's, you know, a very nationalistic epic. And, you know, I wanted to play with the nationalistic sentiment there and kind of turn some of the mythic assumptions on their head. And I hope I've done it respectfully, even though I know that a lot of Latvians might hate me for the, you know, for the things I've done with the traditional myths. But, you know, I think you do have to be careful not to just, like, make Snow White, you know, this warrior princess with this leather, white leather outfit and, like, a mace and, you know.
Which is basically what they are doing. And they tried it with Little Red Riding Hood and got nowhere. But there's another one. There's another Red Riding Hood thing coming out. And, of course, she's also a character in Once Upon a Time. And I'm afraid they don't get it. They only see the surface. And their knowledge of it tends to be very Disney.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe style, your writing at this point?
Well, I've been fairly eclectic. Actually, the past couple of years, even though I've had some visible success with my short fiction, I've only written maybe 3 or 4 or 5 short stories. What I've been working on is this young adult novel, which it's a very grim novel, but the concept is kids with superpowers find giant robots that have taken over the world. So it's you know, it's kind of pop culture meets a very grim and kind of political take on that. So, you know, that's what I do with my longer work. Whereas with my short fiction, I just try to be as varied and eclectic as possible and just write ideas that seem interesting to me. And whether it's fantasy, whether it's science fiction, whether it's, you know, politically charged or just a relationship story or just a whimsy. Like I wrote a story about you know, when pigs fly, just because, you know, it struck me. And, you know, I actually got, it was When Pigs Fly, a military take on that, and I had veterans writing me and telling me they had tears in their eyes when they finished, you know, the story about flying pigs. So, you know, I just love finding all these various random things I can write about and make them kind of powerful and relevant to the reader.
Mm-hmm. You have been nominated for a Nebula Award.
Yeah, I just got the news a few weeks ago when I was in Cuba, and I'm really floored. I wasn't expecting this. My story.
Let me just explain to the listeners, by the way, that the Nebula Award is a peer award given by science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction writers to SAME. It is not like the Hugo Award, which is a reader's award. So personally, to me, I mean, the Hugo Award is great. It means, hey, we read it. We liked it. The Nebula Award is, we are your peers. We're the ones who have been there and who are in your business, and we think this is great. So I just wanted to explain that much to listeners, because I think the Nebula Award says something about the quality, the Nebula nomination says something about the quality of the writing. And they changed how the Nebulas are voted upon about a year ago, and they're starting to get it right, and it's all of a sudden opened up to a whole new bunch of nominees.
Yes, a lot of new writers. It's very exciting if you look at the bio.
So I'm sorry to interrupt your story, but I thought that was good background to explain.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this award has been going for a long time, and basically ever since I was a kid, I dreamt about, you know, dreamt about possibly one day being nominated, so it was shocking and very pleasing, and I'm, you know, very happy about it. And the story was called Mama, We Are Zhenya, Your Son, and it's you can find it in Lightspeed magazine in the April 2011 issue,
which is at Lightspeedmagazine.com. Just wanted to be
And it's for free. It's free. There's a print version, a podcast version. You don't have to pay anything. So,
but rumor is that real soon, like within the next few minutes, there's going to be an author-read version.
Yes, I've heard this rumor, and I suspect it's accurate.
Okay, well, why don't we, at this time, if you're ready, make it accurate? Yes. You want to take a break first?
Yeah.
We'll be back. Cortina Real MK Mark III here over WBAI in New York City. And you're listening to an interview with Tom Crosshill recorded a little earlier this year, in fact, about a month ago. And in fact, in part two, which we're about to hear, and it's now edited, I believe we tell you all the date and all the information. So let's get right to it. This is WBAI New York. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund with me, and I never did slate it earlier. I should have done that. Today is March 9th, 2012. I almost say 1912 because I'm of the 20th century, I think, enjoying some aspects of the 21st century. But today would be, by the way, the 100th anniversary of the publication of A Princess of Mars, which is like the birth of space opera, I think some might say. And but with me is Tom Crosshill, and what he writes is not space opera, but it's a different kind of space. Is that fair?
Yeah, and you'll discover what that means very soon.
Okay, so rather than be cryptic, why don't we enjoy the story?
Very well. So the story is called Mama, We Are Zhenya, Your Son, and it appeared in the April 2011 edition of the Lightspeed magazine, and it has been nominated for the Nebula Award. Mama, this is Zhenya, your son. I'm in a castle with gnomes.
Okay, I'm going to restart this, which we can do since we're recording.
Oh, I didn't edit it expertly.
Now just give me the title again.
The story is called Mama, We Are Zhenya, Your Son. It appeared in the Lightspeed magazine, April 2011, and it's just been nominated for the Nebula Award. Mama, this is Zhenya, your son. I'm in a castle with gnomes. When you said Dr. Olga would pay many rubles for a boy to help her, I was afraid, but I didn't tell you. I didn't want to be selfish, because with rubles you can pay for the hospital so you can be strong again. Now I'm happy that I came. Dr. Olga says I must write what happens in a letter so you can read it and not worry. We can't send pictures because the gnomes have no cameras, silly gnomes, so I will describe everything. I fell asleep in Dr. Olga's big room in the Red University building by the Botanical Garden. I had a helmet on my head, stuffed with wires. There were lots of lights and noises, like in that game which Dimas Papa bought him, and you said we couldn't buy because we don't have a papa or rubles. Then the lights went away, and I was in a castle. It's not like Moscow at all, well, except maybe on the Red Square. There are stone corridors and pretty towers with mushroom tops, and a big hall with a glass roof so you can see the stars when it's dark. The gnomes live in the cellar. They're short and green and wear big fluffy hats with their names on them, like GUI1, GUI2, GUI3, which they said means Gnome User Interface. I asked them for food, but they didn't understand me real good, only jumped around and sang songs. I think Sulik is smarter. Oh yes, Sulik is here. Dr. Olga put a helmet on his head, too. At first he was afraid of the gnomes, but now he barks at them very loud. We found a run place for him, with grass and water. I told Dr. Olga about the linden tree behind our building, where he likes to bury bones, and she put a linden tree in the run place, too. He likes that. Dr. Olga can't come here, but she talks to us sometimes. Her face is in the wall, like the stone is soft and moving. She hasn't told me what work I have to do yet, but I promise I'll work the hardest I can, Mama. Zhenya, your son. Mama, this is Zhenya, your son. We are hungry. It's not so bad for me, but Sulik whines and drags his belly on the floor. Dr. Olga says there is a food place and it's our job to find it, but we can't because the path between places keeps changing. We go all around the castle and we should be where we started and we're not. Start in sleep place, end in run place. Start in run place, end in the big hall. It's like that time I got lost in Izmailovsky Park, and you said I was a stupid boy because anyone could just follow the signs. But there are no signs here. Dr. Olga doesn't help. She says if I train my mind to get from sleep place to food place and food place to sleep place, then I can find the treasure place. I ask her, what treasure place? But she doesn't tell me. I hope she doesn't think I'm stupid too. But maybe I am. Maybe Sulik is hungry because I'm not smart enough. Zhenya, your son. Mama, this is Zhenya, your son. Sulik found the food place. We were in the big hall and he ran away from me like at the carnival with the mirrors, many Suliks in every direction. Then he barked and ran back and pulled at my pants, just one Sulik. When I tried to go with him, there were many Suliks again, and I didn't know which one to follow. Then he brought me a banana, and I got excited, because I remembered the time I got to eat one for my birthday. But the gnomes took it from me before I could have it. I ran after them, but the gnomes are very fast. I told Dr. Olga, and she says I should be more flexible. After all, I am only 8, and my pathways are fresh, and it's really not hard if Sulik can do it. Dr. Olga doesn't know Sulik. He's a very smart dog. I can't win hide-and-seek with him, even with my eyes open. When I watch him run away, there are many Suliks everywhere, so that doesn't help. But when I see him somewhere and go catch him, I can't guess which way he's running and how fast. The gnomes watch and laugh and chant, Heisenberg! 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 I don't get angry at them, though. My Sulik is smarter than me. I'm still hungry. Zhenya, son. P.S. Did you go to the hospital, Mama? Are you all right? Mama, this is Zhenya, your son. I'm afraid, Mama. The gnomes make me play a game, and they hit me when I lose. It hurts very much. Sulik tries to stop them, but they hit him too. And Dr. Olga doesn't come when I call. It's a hard game. The gnomes have a big gold box with 2 rooms and a paper wall and no door in the wall. They put me in 1 room by the wall and they leave me. There's a dragon painted on the wall, all red and black. The gnomes say I must get to the other room or the dragon will eat me. But the dragon doesn't come. The gnomes come back later and ask me, why are you still in this room? And then they hit me and make me do it again. One time, I broke the paper wall and went to the other room, and they got very angry and hit me many times and said I shouldn't do that. Tunnel, they say, use a tunnel. But the floor is hard, and I don't even have a shovel. What can I do, Mama? I know I must try hard for you, but it hurts. Shenya, your son, waiting for your letter. Mama, the dragon came. She came, and I was so scared. I went through the wall, and it didn't break. Only she came again on the other side, and I couldn't run away. She burned me. She burned me real bad, Mama. I'm sorry, Mama. I'm sure I did something very bad, but I don't know what. Please, can I leave now? I know we need rubles, but I'm scared. Please, Mama? Mama, I think this is Zhenya, your son. I'm not sure. Nothing is sure. I understand that now. Everything is and is not. The dragon helped me understand. A wall is no wall if I'm everywhere. I can find the food place now if every one of me goes looking. Every me doesn't find every food place, but one of me finds a food place. I don't know why I was all in one place before. I think all the little parts of me, they could be many different places, but they disagreed. They pulled in different directions, like in that story about the wagon and the horses, so they stayed in place. Now every little piece of me agrees, and I am everywhere I want to be. Oh yes, Dr. Olga came back. I was angry about the dragon, but she said, it's okay, because I can go home soon. You always said I should keep my mouth shut around aunts and uncles, Mama. I try very hard with Dr. Olga, but I don't like her so much anymore. She says my pathway's changed. A miracle of tabula rasa, she says. A young mind can learn to think quantumically in a simulated quantumical environment. I think she wanted to talk very much, because she said many more things about how she proved the brain of somebody named Penrose is real, which is silly, because how could a brain not be real? Then she looked very strange and cried. I asked her why, and she said many important aunts and uncles would be very happy and put her name in books, which I guess is important, like when you get a Guinness record for how big a cake you can bake. I don't care about any of that, Mama. I just want to come home. Zhenya, probably your son. Mama, we are Zhenya, your son. All of I found the... Dr. Olga says I have to write clearly because you can't understand. Is that why you don't send me letters, Mama? I'm sorry. I want you to write very much. I found the treasure place. It's on the roof with the stars right above. The treasure is a groaning metal thing as big as a house. I knew what it was as soon as I saw it, because gnomes were standing in a circle, holding their hats and singing, "Treasure, treasure, treasure!" I'm not sure it's a very good treasure if gnomes have to tell you what it is. And Sulik doesn't like it. I called him over, but he just barked and wouldn't come near. Anyway, I thought the treasure was interesting. There are so many handles you can pull. It's like a big yellow hedgehog with twisting, knobbly gears which are never in the same place when you look. Dr. Olga said she couldn't understand the treasure because it's a quantumical motor and it needs a quantumical brain. But I should understand it because I've got one. And she's right. When I'm everywhere at once, I get all tangled up with the treasure and the handles become my arms like I'm conducting an orchestra. And I understand everything. But it's scary when that happens, Mama. The castle becomes squishy like plasticine in my hands, and I can shape it. I was very bad at shaping it at first, so I broke the food place. There were sparks everywhere, and Dr. Olga said the hash had overflowed, though I don't know why, because I never saw potatoes in the food place. Then I learned to stretch the castle, so for every thin part, there is a thick part, and it doesn't break. I stretched and I stretched until I could see through to other castles. Mama, there are many castles just like this one, except each a little different. Some are a lot different. And when I stretch more with the handles, I can make openings to those other castles and reach through and be in all castles at once. Dr. Olga said I should grab rooms and light from the other castles and bring them back so we have more energy. I did it. But I think there's another Zhenya and another Sulik in each of the other castles, and they didn't like it because there was a loud noise and the castle moved very much and some of the gnomes screamed and fell to the ground. Now there's green blood on their hats and they don't move anymore. Dr. Olga said not to worry, it's a software glitch and they're not important anyway. I don't like the gnomes, but I think that's not very nice of her. The treasure hurt them and it's all because of her. I'm scared, Mama. Zhenya, your son we are. Mama, today Dr. Olga told me to use the treasure to look out of the castle and at the big room where Sulik and I went to sleep. I moved the handles to stretch the air, and I saw us sleeping on a long table, Sulik and me. Aunts and uncles worked all around, and in the middle of the room there was a big metal box. It hummed and flashed lights when I moved the handles of the treasure. I think the metal box is like the treasure, except it's in Moscow and it doesn't move. When I used the treasure and the box started to make noises, all the aunts and uncles looked very excited and not afraid. I thought it was dumb because I was very afraid. Dr. Olga told me to use the treasure to open other Moscows, like I'd opened other castles. But when I stretched the big room thin, I saw bad little fast things come out of the metal box. They were hitting Dr. Olga and all the aunts and uncles, so I stopped. The aunts and uncles and Dr. Olga didn't believe me because they couldn't see the bad little fast things. Dr. Olga said they had Geiger counters and eye-on chambers, and there was nothing there. She said I had to use the treasure to get energy from other Moscows, because only I had a quantumical brain, and the whole world was waiting, and anyway, Sulik wanted me to. I said no. I don't think Sulik wants me to do a bad thing. I asked him, and he licked me, which is not very bad. He just wants to sleep with me under the linden tree in the sun. When I told Dr. Olga that, she said she can't give me rubles if I don't help with the treasure. I think maybe that is important, but some of I are not sure anymore. In some Moscow, always, she gives me rubles. In some Moscow, always, she does not give me rubles. Both happen always. You're sick, and you're fine, always, Mama. Some of you in some Moscow. If that is so, always, why should I help? All is, always, somewhere. But the bad little fast things are bad everywhere. Zhenya, your son we are. Mama, okay. I will help Dr. Olga with the treasure tomorrow. Okay, okay, I will help. All of I love Sulik. When Dr. Olga said she will hurt Sulik, I thought many Suliks everywhere. Can't hurt all Suliks. We will be okay. But she took Sulik away from the castle, and when I used the treasure, I saw him standing alone by the table with my body. Outside in Moscow. He looked very sad with his head all shaved. Dr. Olga came and took him away, and now I can't see him at all, but he barks very loud like he hurts, and it's hard to remember there are other Suliks in other Moscows. I don't think Dr. Olga is nice. I think maybe she was never nice. I think maybe when she promised us rubles, she didn't really mean it. Please, ask her to give me Sulik back. I'll be good, I promise. I'll do anything she wants. Mama, Zhenya, son, I put this letter your table. Don't afraid. Don't scream. Yes, hide under bed. Under bed safe. Don't open windows. Don't go outside. Moscow not safe. Hungry smoke bad. I protect you. Sorry, write little. Only have fingers if think hard. Zhenya. Mama, Zhenya again. Got more time now, so I can write better. Please, come out from under the bed. Don't stare like that. Aren't you happy that I'm back? I know I look scary, but at least I'm strong enough for eyes and fingers. I can't talk, but I can write you letters. I saw you got all the old letters I wrote for you. You must have been very busy at the hospital if you couldn't answer. That's okay. I'm glad Dr. Olga gave you the rubles after all. You look stronger. Soon I'll be stronger too, Mama. I'll have arms, many, many arms, and I'll hold you, and we'll be together. Won't that be lovely, Mama? You always took care of me, even when I was stupid and bad, and now I'll take care of you and won't ever, ever, ever let you go. Won't that be great? But we won't have Sulik. He died, Mama. When I started the treasure, the metal box in Dr. Olga's room growled, and Sulik ran out of a closet barking. Then the air stretched and broke, and out came all the bad little fast things. They flowed together and became the hungry smoke, and came flying, buzz, 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 like many black bees. I stopped the treasure, but it was too late. The hungry smoke buzzed and wrapped around Sulik, and he barked and barked, and then the hungry smoke ate his head, and I couldn't do anything. I thought maybe it's okay, because there are other Suliks in other Moscows, but it didn't feel okay. It didn't feel okay at all, Mama. Then the smoke barked like Sulik, loud and sad. It barked lots, while it ate all the aunts and uncles, and Dr. Olga too. Dr. Olga screamed very long, and I thought maybe she wanted another Guinness record, but she stopped, and the smoke ate her head too. After that, the smoke gave up barking and whispered things, real soft like Dr. Olga. Take, take, take from us, steal from us. No, boy, no, 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 no. It ate my head last, because I was on the table and couldn't run. When I heard it coming, boy, 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 I ran to the castle, but the castle got dark, so I came back. I got real scared, and I twisted the treasure very much, and the metal box roared, and I ripped open the air between the castle and Moscow, and I came through all the way, all of me, everywhere. I tried using my body again, but it didn't work. The hungry smoke ate my head after all. It didn't even hurt because I was everywhere at once. Don't worry about me, Mama. It's okay. Sorry about Moscow. I couldn't help all the aunts and uncles and boys and girls and grandmas and grandpas. Sorry about the blood and the screaming. It makes me want to cry, but I don't have any tears. I don't think crying would help anyway. I couldn't protect everyone, but at least I protected you. The smoke won't get into the apartment, don't you worry, Mama. I think it's real angry, because we tried to steal from its Moscow, and it gets smarter when it eats heads, like when I read books. But you've got me, and I'm smart too, and I'm everywhere. I have to catch the hungry smoke now. I hope I can use Dr. Olga's metal treasure box and stretch the air and send it all home. Then I'll come for you. You just hold on. Zhenya. Mama, I caught much hungry smoke and sent it home. I promised we wouldn't steal from Mother Moscow's again, but it just yelled, slide the curb, blast the boy, twisted metric. It sounded like uncles and aunts and grandpas and grandmas and little kids too, happy and sad and angry and calm. I think maybe eating all those heads wasn't so good for it. I think maybe it got confused. I'm home, Mama. I sit next to you right now, here on the couch. Do you feel my fingers on your back? See the curtains move? It's me, Mama. Smile, Mama. Please, why won't you smile? Once I catch the last of the smoke, we'll be together for good. We can even go to Paris like you always wanted. I don't think the smoke got to Paris. But before that, can you help me? Look outside the door. I left Sulik there. His fur is sticky, and his head is gone. Can you wash him, Mama? Can you bury him in the garden under the linden tree? When everyone died, I thought I was sad, but I wasn't sure. There are many Moscows, and this is only one Moscow, so why is it important anyway? But then I remembered Sulik. There was only one Sulik who mattered in the end. That means there will always be only one Sulik. I will remember him. All of I, for sure. Sulik taught me that, even being quantumical, I can still know things for sure. Zhenya, your son. All of I, for sure.
You've been listening to Mama, We Are Zhenya, Your Son. Read for you by the author, Tom Crosshill. There'll be a music break there. And now we're back magically. That's it's funny. It's blood curdling. It's a great story.
Thanks. Yeah, I, you know, the reactions I've been getting are either people really love it or they're really confused. And two separate people, both doctors, after reading this, have told me they wondered if I was schizophrenic after reading this story. They were not science fiction fans, so, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me a little bit from the perspective that it takes of Fondly Fahrenheit by Alfred Bester. Do you know that story?
That one I haven't read, no.
Oh, that's a wonderful. I think you would like that story. Let's say that if I took that story and I wanted to pair it, like one would pair a wine with a meal.
Right.
I think they would pair together very well.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, it's a good one about an android. It's a 1940s story about an android who, under certain conditions, becomes a killer. And the owner and the android share memory and share thought. And it's an unreliable narrator. We're not sure who's narrating. Is it the android? Is it the doctor? Sure. The owner?
Well, I mean, Bester is fantastic. And with his fiction, a lot of the time, you really can't tell if he's crazy or not. But it's just so brilliant.
He was nuts. Like, having had him on the show a few times, he was delightfully, wonderfully nuts in the best sense of the word. I mean, he was a character, let's put it that way.
Of course, you have Tiger, which is just such a brilliant book.
Yeah, which most people don't know that's the title of the book. We're discussing, of course, The Star Is My Destination. Right. But the real title is Tiger, T-Y-G-E-R, after Blake.
Yeah.
And although it's been printed as T-I-G-E-R, which is when Alfie autographed the book for me as Star Is My Destination, he wrote in it, "We know the real title, T-Y-T-L-E, don't we, Jim?" Which was a very... So just for those people who even know Bester, Star Is My Destination and Demolished Man are two of my favorite classics.
And really, it should... I mean, it's just mind-blowing because if you read The Star Is My Destination or Tiger, it's... you know, reading it today, if it were an author working today, I would think, oh, it's a good book. It's even a great book, but I wouldn't be that blown away. But that's because the perspective is so modern. It feels so fresh, so contemporary. And I don't know when he wrote it, but it was decades and decades ago. I mean, it's
the late 40s, early 50s, somewhere in there.
I mean, it's like unbelievable.
It's a minimum of 60 years ago,
and
which is
frightening. Could have written it today. It would still, I mean, there are some details, but for the most part, it would still feel fresh. And,
it really would. You would tweak a few references here or there, but for the most part, it would be the same thing. But no, I definitely, as I said, I would definitely pair some of your writing with some of Bester's writing.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Oh, yes. No, it is. It is. I mean, you know, to compare somebody to Alfie Bester is not exactly a put down, is it?
No.
Because he is truly one of the greats. And the story, and what's great is that here's a story that you weren't even familiar with.
Yeah.
That, as I say, it sort of pairs well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is a strong influence in this story, and that would be Keyes' Flowers for Algernon.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I took the narrative structure from that story, and I just wanted to play with that. Flowers for Algernon being one of the most famous stories in science fiction history.
There, okay, I'm sorry. You were saying we had leak through from another studio.
So
a busy hive, WBAI.
Yes. So looking at Flowers for Algernon, that story had a cyclical structure, which the ending came back to mirror the beginning. And, you know, I love that story, but that always frustrated me. And then I had the science fictional idea for this story, for Mama, We Are Shenya, Your Son, which is very different from Algernon, which is this quantum mechanics and the quantum brain and all that. And I figured I would couple that kind of with the letter-style structure of Flowers for Algernon, but I didn't want the cycle. I didn't want it to come back to where it started. So I kind of blew the ending as wide open as I possibly could. And that was the genesis of the story, basically.
Yeah, but for me, it's funny that when I think of what it harmonizes with in my brain, there is Heinlein, you're the jackpot, where the world basically sort of blows up because of different things happening. It's simply, but that's an outer perspective. This one's an inner perspective. Bester again, something up there likes me, where a satellite basically is going to destroy the Earth, but it's going to protect just, you know, a couple of its creators from it. And it's written from the satellite's point of view. Occasionally, again, Bester is so much fun with the unreliable narrator.
Right.
Not unreliable, but we don't know exactly who or what that is.
Right.
So somehow your story is both extremely modern and very classic.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I tried to write something that would appeal to people who would not understand, you know, the science and the science fictional references. Because, you know, there's
and by the way, the computer puns in there.
Yeah.
The GUI on the GNOME's please. There are three people in the world. I used to be a Linux. I was editor of a website about Linux.
Yeah.
It's the only reason I got that.
But even if you don't get that, it's still, you know, graphical user interface, GNOME user interface.
Anyway, yes, exactly. Exactly.
I was playing with those things. Well, what I wanted to suggest with those things and a few others was kind of play with the child's point of view. And, you know, for some people it worked very, very well, but I've got, you know, other people didn't find that authentic. So I've just, it's been interesting to watch the reactions.
That's curious.
I think it's also a question of what children you come into contact with in everyday life, and there are very different kids. And you know, I just found it so much fun to explore how a kid might, you know, confronted with quantum mechanics, confronted with all this computer stuff, like how a kid might perceive that and talk about that. And
But because it's about quantum mechanics, it's also got that inner point of view that's it's not just computer or anything. It's cosmological, literally cosmological.
And really, the core of the story isn't quantum mechanics, because parallel universes, everybody's familiar with, and there's nothing new at this point. What this story is really about, from a science fictional point of view, is Penrose's theory of the quantum brain, as in that the human brain has some quantum properties that, you know, give us free will. And my idea was that if you can train a human brain to understand quantum events natively, to, so to speak, in real time, that would be a strong indication that the human brain is actually a quantum computer on some level. So that was what I was exploring here. And that, you know, that was kind of the core of the story for me, but I think it's very easy not to see that unless, you know, you have all the right background when reading the story.
Yep.
So, you know, there's lots of other elements in there.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's got so many layers, and one of the questions I would ask is, if you have heard, what is the experience from people who know nothing of quantum mechanics, nothing of science fiction?
Mm-hmm.
There's still a story in there that I think people can follow on without going into all the many layers that you've got hidden in there.
Yeah, no,
or not hidden, but
people do enjoy it, and they enjoy the emotional aspect. But you know, they also go like, you know, it reads a bit schizophrenic, which is not surprising if you're not familiar with quantum mechanics and how those things work.
But it is from the human brain point of view, and the fact that it is quantum mechanics, it is schizophrenic.
Yeah,
it has to be. I mean, that's.
I mean, I'm not at all dismayed by this. I find it hilarious, and
I think it's wonderful. No, but I would agree that it's schizophrenic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, because for those who don't understand some of the fun of quantum mechanics, it says that matter thinking items, for lack of a better word, quanta, can be in two places at once at the same time.
Yeah, I mean,
and aware of it all.
What's really interesting to me, I mean, this is kind of an exploration of artificial intelligence, because the way we've, as a society, have primarily been going about trying to get at artificial intelligence is making bigger and bigger computers and tough, you know, more sophisticated computers. But like, what I think might ultimately prove to be one key way of approaching it is taking the human brain, which already has intelligence in it, and if you can kind of replicate the human brain, but from day one, place it in a different environment, maybe a simulated environment. You know, it's the old sci-fi idea of putting it at the core of a warship, or putting it, connecting it to a mathematical program,
the ship
or whatever.
Sang kind
yeah,
of
and,
stuff.
And you can, but you know,
you mentioned McCaffrey earlier.
Yeah, but those writers, great books, but they didn't explore, you know, the a lot of the time they didn't explore the ideas underlying that, which is
the
flexibility of the human mind and how you could actually train people. If you put somebody in, you put a baby's brain, okay, this is going to be gruesome and I don't advocate doing this, but you put a baby's brain into a warship and then you associate...
Kids, don't try this at home.
Yes. And you associate pain and pleasure rewards with successfully controlling the warship and doing the things you're supposed to do. Possibly you could train, a baby's brain to evolve to be a warship brain and, you know, do everything you need to be. Need to have it do, and it's one way of
Ender's Game gone mad.
Exactly, and ideally, of course, it wouldn't be an actual baby's brain, but just an artificially grown brain.
Again, it depends on who you're talking to. Yeah. It's like there are those governments out there,
that just say,
collateral damage, but look what we're getting out of it.
You know, we were talking about it with some. I just came down from Boston and visiting some friends at Harvard, and we're talking about this exact same thing. And, their speculation was that somewhere in the middle of some third world country, there are labs where, people might be doing all sorts.
Third world?
We're
in New York. Why are you going all the way out there?
So you
this
think
is New York. You think it's not happening somewhere?
Yes.
In this
there's a whole another world.
Area 82
In the subway system of New York City. So perhaps there are secret labs, next to the mole people underground. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Makes for a better story, anyway.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. But the way the story hits me, I love it on many levels. I haven't listened to Stefan Rudnicki's version that's on lightspeedmagazine.com where they have a podcast of it, and I will listen to it. But hearing you read it, I got a whole other layer of meanings and subtleties and all that than when I read it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
It would almost be fun, even though this is originally printed online, to do yet another online version with all the hypertext to Penrose, to all these references, to all these places.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very much in keeping with the story because it's a very meta story. It's very hypertextual type of story. It has so many layers. And I've always wanted people to write for the web.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people have done it. Jeff Ryman has done it.
It gets very hard, and it's very hard to scale it to other outlets, so people tend not to do that.
Yeah, but I'll tell you where it would work, radio.
Yeah.
But that's what the podcast is, and that's what you just did. But I'm envisioning like the radio drama version.
Yeah,
it would take very little.
I know. This story in particular seems to work very well for readings. I read this at FinCon, the big Finnish science fiction convention, which is really a lot of fun every year. And
that's funny because, there's a radio production outlet called Big Finish, but they have only one N. They do the Doctor Who things for the BBC.
No, this would be the Scandinavian one.
And, two N's, yes.
And, it just got a fantastic reaction when I read it aloud, and they picked it up to translate it for their Takti Valtaja, the big Finnish science fiction magazine. And every time I read it, it gets a great reception. So I think there's something about, there are a lot of layers, and it's easy to miss one or two of them when you're just reading, and the author can help bring them out. Maybe I've missed some opportunities to bring it out in the text, and I just know in my head, so when I read it, I present that. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, you're not done with it yet. That's one of the beauties of the web, is that you can – whenever I've interviewed Samuel R. Delaney and whenever he has read something for me, he starts blue penciling. I swear, you know, take a 30, 40-year-old story that, right. that won this award and that award, and all of a sudden he takes a look and he says, actually, it would be good for him. He did this live on the air.
I think you've got to resist that. At least I think you've got to resist that.
You know, I think so, too. But for himself,
yeah.
You know, he wanted to do that. And
well, I find myself doing things like when reading, I will add a conjunction here, a little word here or there, just, you know, whatever feels natural at the moment, but I'll try not to edit the story overall.
Yeah. But it's, I'm just thinking, given the medium.
Yeah. No, you can play with things.
You can play with it, yeah. And this is a story that, given its layers, I think would facilitate that.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
So I'm still working on my novel, which I'm
Your YA
earlier.
Novel.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the big project. And then I just finished the new science fiction story that I need to revise, but which is basically kind of my attempt to cross, you know, to find the intersection between literary and science fiction. And because I think a lot of what we've done with science fiction recently is, I mean, in general, not just recently, is we are very obsessed with finding the new thing, and every new story has to have some new idea, new concept, new technology, or whatever. But we haven't always fully considered the, we haven't even fully considered the human implications of all the technologies that come into our lives, I mean, every day, right now. Like, I don't know if anyone's writing literary fiction, like, you know, Jonathan Franzen-style literary fiction about, like, Twitter and iPads. I mean, not about that, but like having that as a component of, you know, everyday reality and how that impacts our relationships, how that impacts, you know, everything that we do. So I'm
a few people have, some of it very comic.
Yeah.
Like Ian Fraser in The New Yorker has done, you know, like tweets from the Pope.
Yeah.
And things, and you know, things like that.
There's a little bit of that.
There's a little
there's
bit
a lot
of
more opportunity, I think.
But you know, but the next question is, and I think this is the place where you're going more, is it's fascinating to note that with the exception of a very few writers, Orson Scott Card being one of them, Heinlein another, they weren't writing about carrying your computers with you. The idea of the portable computer just wasn't there. But Scott Card, when he was writing the sequel to Ender's Game, Speaker for the Dead, had people blogging. I mean, that's he didn't use the word, but Ender was constantly writing and people were instantly reading and responding. I think you too are reaching almost toward that the next media, the next thing that will be a commonplace in our lives.
Well, perhaps, but what I'm really saying is that we already have a lot here that we're not talking about. And yes, there is room for exploring the new thing, and that's the science fictional aspect. But I think you can write literary fiction today, which almost reads like science fiction because it deals with primarily with technology, but it's real technology. It's technology that's here already. And, you know, that doesn't have to be the core of the story, but like every interaction today is informed by that. If you have a long distance relationship, you know, and you get on Skype with someone, you know, that, yeah, that's a trivial example, but like there are literary things and you can explore about, you know, that sort of thing.
And I know this is occasionally happening because, let's see, when you participated in the last Altered Fluid show, were you where were you?
I recorded one in my living room in Latvia.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually get live phone calls from one particular listener in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
And because he's listening through the internet, and then he's calling, and then he's Skyping the call in.
Yeah.
And okay, that's fun to note. And I also notice occasionally where hits from the website come from and outside of England. Mm-hmm. I notice that I often get one hit in Bulgaria and one hit in Latvia. Well, I know who the Latvian is. Yeah. And it is funny, but again, it's the thing that people are still not taking for granted. They may even be living it. They're walking around with their eye things.
But like when you look at the novels that are coming out, it's like, okay, well, people have caught on that cell phones exist, but like a lot of the time, you know, it seems also in movies, it seems like there's no modern technology, you know, that doesn't.
There are exceptions.
Of course, there are. I mean,
like the new Sherlock.
Yeah,
there are definitely exceptions.
There are definitely exceptions. But when you look at the kind of, you know, gross amount of media that's being produced and how much of it actually reflects today as opposed to 1990. You know, it's something to explore.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is a the 20-year difference.
Yeah.
I think it's greater from 1990 to 2010 than it was from 1970 to 1990 in many ways.
Arguably. What's the great closing question?
I think we've covered where you're probably going with your fiction.
Well, we can reading recommendations, let's say reading recommendations.
Okay, that's always good.
And I just – because –
And also we have to mention your website and all
yes,
that.
Yes. I just wanted to mention that so within – with the Nebula Awards this year, I'm up in the short story category, but the ballot itself is really impressive this year, and we have a lot
it
of
really
young
is.
Writers, a lot of really talented writers, and I highly recommend going to the, you know, going online, just Google the Nebula Awards. You'll see what the nominees are.
SFWA.org.
Yeah.
But just type, just Google in Nebula Awards 2012.
And you know, there are so many fantastic short stories, novelettes, and novels and up for the awards. I mean, I've
and there
really
are often links to those,
yeah.
as there is for yours.
Many are free online, and, you know, it's just a fantastic way to see what's going on in the genre and just have a great time reading some
yeah.
amazing
especially
stories.
If you're not familiar with the genre or if you're one of those many, many people, the most common thing is science fiction. Oh, yeah, I used to read that.
Right.
Is anybody writing this stuff today?
Or if you're a crotchety old college professor who doesn't believe that science fiction can be literary, you might also want to check out some of those stories.
Nah. If you're one of those people,
you're not going to change. Probably
you're not going to change. No, you're not going to change. You're buried. You're gone. We know who you are, and interestingly enough, I know any number of people who had college professors like that,
mm-hmm.
and many really great science fiction writers yeah. came out of their classes.
Exactly,
it's an interesting thing.
Yeah. Yes, but thanks for having me on the show. I'm Tom Crosshill. I have a website at www.tomcrosshill.com. And, you know, I have links to many free stories online as well as stories you can purchase. And I'd love to, you know, have people reading all that stuff.
Okay. And we'll have you back, possibly even by Skype or something.
That would be very 21st century.
It really would be. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And, well, it just about timed out, even with the strange edits in there. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Tom Crosshill, for being there. And next week, our live guest will be Aliyah Dawn Johnson. And, well, trust me, you'll love her. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way shortly. And we go out, of course, with Steel Eye Span, Sails of Silver. Take care. Happy Holy Week. Happy Pesach. All that good stuff. Take care. Oh,
live now. A revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and ripping to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ash. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute.
Yeah.
You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment.
Yeah.
So why wanna scold me when
I toss the flag, I'm only doing what you told me.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you.
F you.
America too. Yeah. See, I made up this new
99 Cent Calista live right here, your favorite radio station. 5 minutes after flag burning time, 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. 99 Cinco. Pacifica Radio at its very best. 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. List alive until 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera kicks in. But before that, Free Speech Radio News right here at 99 Cinco. List on the radio until we burn the American flag to ashes. Fishbone, y'all. List alive, 99 Cinco. Dodoy. 212-209-2900. Burn, baby, burn, y'all. Yeah. Yes, I am. 99 Cinco. List alive.
Do all types of weather. You will be a slave to the junkie maker forever. Fiend for the means while it taxes your mind. You're on the road to the tomb, don't come alone. Fiend like a hype as you suck on the glass pipe. Your soul is cast into a hellish hole. And as you're on your knees trying to feed your disease, the monkeys on your back got you begging, please. Yeah. You're cheating the light, you no longer see. Burn down, burn down in your misery. Try to let your soul confess and assume the position. Constipated, conceited, this is a purgatory and stated.
Pray to the junkie maker, pray to the junkie maker.
It's the death ticket, can I get a witness?
Pray to the junkie maker,
make a hit with your lips.
Pray to the junkie maker,
oh.
Pray to the junkie maker,
make a hit.
To Memphis. The moral to this story, so listen well.
I relate to life I live in, full of tension sometimes.
You will see that the pipe is your reality.
Pray to the junkie maker.
Mental shitty, oh, mental shitty in the city. And you will find you'll be a junkie with a zombie mind. Suck the pipe, take your life, and you will die. I'll be careful.
This List Alive 99 Cinco.
Cinco.